So we're continuing through John's Gospel, and so far in the first three messages from the first chapter, we've heard a lot of verbal testimony about Jesus. The first bit was the writer's testimony about Jesus, the first 18 verses, the prologue of John's Gospel, as the Gospel writer John writes about Jesus. Then John the Baptist takes over, and we hear things that John the Baptist said about Jesus. And then the third group giving verbal testimony to Jesus is the disciples, the new disciples that are starting to follow Jesus in verses 37 through to 51. So from those three sources, from the writer himself, from John the Baptist, and from the new disciples, there is verbal testimony about who Jesus is. But now John turns to the actions of Jesus and the words of Jesus in his public ministry from chapters 2 through to 12 of the Gospel. And through Jesus' actions and through his preaching that he records, John is going to show us more and more about who Jesus is. He states his aim and his purpose at the end of his gospel, and I think we've mentioned it before, but it bears repeating in John 20, verses 30 and 31. Jesus did many other miraculous signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. From lots and lots of possible material, John has chosen certain stories of Jesus' actions and words in order to fulfill his purpose in writing the gospel, his purpose of bringing people to trust in Jesus Christ. It's usually considered that John has seven miracles in his gospel, but he doesn't call them miracles, he calls them signs rather than miracles. Signs point to something, and that's for him is what these miracles do. They point to who Jesus is. They're also, mention it briefly now, seven I am sayings. So seven sign miracles and seven I am sayings are part of the structure of how John gets his message over. With the miracles, though, there are a couple of extras as well. So there's the seven in the first part of the gospel, and then there's the resurrection itself and one post-resurrection miracle in chapter 21. So seven signs but nine miracles that John chooses to include in his gospel. I've listed those for you on the notes. As we start out this series, we'll come across them as we go through. But the water into wine, the healing of an official son, healing of a paralyzed man, feeding of the 5,000, walking on water, sight for a blind man, and the raising of Lazarus. When you read the other gospel accounts, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, you'll notice that there are other miracles in there. And that, of course, fits in with what John says. John says he did lots of other miraculous things as well. But I'm telling you about these because, put together, they will help you to know who Jesus is and to trust in him. So let's think about the story and the miracle that takes place. It starts out by saying, on the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. The Gospels have an appearance of being chronological, but they're not always strictly chronological. So on the third day, there's differences of opinions as to what that means. It may be the third day after he met Nathanael, which was the previous story in chapter 1. It could be that it's just the third day of the week. And that leads me to another confusion for myself as I was studying it this week. Some commentators say that the third day of the week, which would be Tuesday in our calendar, was a popular day for Jewish weddings. Unfortunately, another person that was writing about it said first weddings were on Wednesdays and widows got married on Thursdays. I've not had time to research more thoroughly into why these commentators disagree on the days of the week that weddings would have taken place. So the party then took a week on top of that as well. So the third day, it may be just following on. He met Nathanael and they travelled up to Galilee. It took a few days. So on the third day, it was time for a wedding. Or it could just be the third day of a week that John is now writing about. We can't always be too strict on the chronology. That I say, albeit I made a point about John the Baptist not having been put in prison in chapter 4. So it's difficult because we have a Western idea and we prefer a clear chronology. But the gospel writers were writing at a time when a clear chronology wasn't necessary. It wasn't considered important for an accurate account. Alistair's going to be preaching on the next passage in chapter 2 next week, and I don't know whether this will make it more difficult for him or not, but chapter 2, you could think, oh, that carries on straight after the story of the water into the wine. In the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark and Luke, the clearing of the temple is at the end of Jesus' ministry, just before his crucifixion. If you look at how John introduces it, it's not necessarily straight after he turned water into wine. So he could just be including a story from the end of Jesus' ministry next to this one and putting the two stories together to tell a similar point. And I'll come to that a bit later as well, and hopefully not steal too much of Alistair's thunder for next week. It could be, of course, that Jesus cleared the temple twice as well. That's a possibility. He did go up to Jerusalem many times in his time of ministry. So, the third day, we're not quite sure what to make of that. He goes to Cana. Cana's not far from Nazareth, where Jesus grew up and where his family was based, only about 6 miles, another local village in the area. And quite possibly the families in Nazareth would know the families in Cana and vice versa. From the story, it would certainly seem that there was a family connection between Jesus' family, Mary's family, and the family holding the wedding in Cana. It's unlikely that Mary would have been worried about the wine in the way she was if she wasn't in some way involved, connected with the family of the wedding. So it's a natural thing for them to be there. In fact, the whole of Cana would probably be there because a wedding was a community event. Cana was not a huge place. Everyone would have been at the wedding, plus friends and family from other villages and towns locally. Wedding celebrations were very important, and it was the groom's obligation to make sure that all the preparations were made. Preparations for the marriage and preparations for the celebration of the marriage. So the couple would be betrothed, and probably a year of betrothal before the wedding. And that was the time that the groom was making preparations. Probably building a house was one of the major preparations for them to live in after the wedding. But also making sure that there was food and drink for the celebration. It was the groom's obligation. So if something was missing in the celebration, it could be considered to be sort of humiliating, really. And well, if you can't provide enough for the celebration, are you going to be able to provide for your new wife? It was kind of casting doubt on his ability as a husband, not just his ability to hold a party, but if he can't do that, will he provide for the wife through the next few years? So quite a serious thing that the wine should run out at the party. Mary involves Jesus in this. You might think straight away Mary expects a miracle. But would she expect that? She does know that her son is special, but he's not done any miracles yet. So would she expect a miracle? Why is she involving him? Joseph's not on the scene anymore. Most likely Mary is now a widow. And Jesus, as the eldest son, would have been the man of the house. So Mary would be quite used to turning to him for advice and help in any problems. So it may just be very practical like that, not Mary saying, "Jesus, do a miracle." But Jesus, what should we do? Some translations of the Bible have Jesus' response as, "Woman, why do you involve me?" Which sounds quite harsh. The NIV puts a "dear" in there, "dear woman." The word is a title of respect. Maybe "lady" would be a good translation as well. Jesus later refers to Mary Magdalene as "woman" in this way, and to Mary, his mother, when he's on the cross, entrusting her to John's care. He uses the same title. It's not as harsh as it might seem. "Woman, why do you involve me?" This is the beginning of Jesus' public ministry. In a sense, this is the time when Jesus is coming out of Mary's household and becoming independent. So maybe that's something of, "Why do you involve me? I don't have to do what you instruct me anymore. I'm now independent." But he also seems to suggest something to do with the timing of his ministry. If he starts to do miracles, it'll be leading towards the climax of his ministry. He says, "My time has not yet come." But then he carries on and he does a miracle in order to show his glory. So perhaps his time is now coming. The miracle itself is somewhat understated, really, in the account, isn't it? We hear about the jars being filled, and we hear about a ladleful being poured out for the master of the banquet. But there's no dramatic description of water turning into wine. The jars are filled to the brim, so that there's no room for, you know, a quick trick like I did of putting some wine in there to make it appear. And they would have drunk the wine diluted anyway. So whether, again, the detail just isn't there. This isn't presumably 100% wine that the master of the banquet's drinking, but the appropriate proportion that they would have drank. But there's no indication of exactly where it happened. It could even have happened in the ladling out rather than in the jar itself. But certainly at some point, Jesus turned water into wine. The jars that he used were used for ceremonial washing. That's why they're stone jars rather than earthenware jars. Food, oil and wine would have been kept in earthenware jars, but for ceremonial washing, water was kept in stone jars. And the Jews would have washed their hands before the meal, between the courses. They would have washed the utensils. They were quite ritualistic in their religion. Jesus takes those jars of water and provides wine for the party. And then at the end, we hear John's comment on it, the first of his miraculous signs. And he revealed his glory, and the disciples put their faith in him. So how do people interpret this story? Why is John chosen to include this story in his gospel? He could have included different miracles in order for Jesus to show his glory, but he chooses to show Jesus turning water into wine. And looking at different commentaries, you get lots of different ideas as to why John includes this story about Jesus. One we have on one of our church poster boards that we sometimes put outside. water into wine, Jesus can change you also. Have I paraphrased that? Or remembered it? Changed you too. So it's a miracle of change. Jesus can change you too. Let's just pop that there. I think as a basic starting point for the meaning, you've got to go with what John himself says in the Gospel. And so it's that demonstration of Jesus' glory and creating the faith. He didn't just reveal his glory, but he revealed his glory in such a way that his disciples put their faith in him. They didn't just believe in him, they put their faith in him. An active process. Miracles don't always result in faith. Again, a danger of preempting something for later on in the series. Just pop into chapter 12 for a moment. John 12 and verse 37. Even after Jesus had done all these miraculous signs in their presence, they still would not believe in him. So there's some people who, even when you give them lots of evidence about who Jesus is, whether that be their being present when miracles take place, or whether it be, you know, with persuasive arguments about evidence for the Christian faith, there's still some people who, despite the evidence, choose not to believe in God and in Jesus. And then also in verse 42, at the same time, many even among the leaders believed in him. But because of the Pharisees, they would not confess their faith for fear that they would be put out of the synagogue. For they loved praise from men more than praise from God. There are some who see the miracles but still choose not to believe in Jesus. There are some who see the miracles and believe in Jesus but do not follow him because they're more worried about men than about God. And then there are the disciples in the story who see the miracle and they put their faith in Jesus. They follow him. Perhaps we know people in those different camps. Do those three groups describe everyone in the world in a way? Not all who believe choose to follow. Where are you this morning in those three groups? Do you follow? Do you put your faith in Jesus like the disciples did? Let's think a little bit more about any other interpretations that may come from this story. Already hinted a little bit about this story, water into wine, and the next story, Jesus clearing the temple. If it's not a strict chronology, why does John choose to put these stories next to each other? Could think in the same way, chapters 3 and 4. There's the stories in chapter 3 of a very religious man, Nicodemus, meeting Jesus. And then in chapter 4, a very irreligious woman meeting Jesus. And maybe in those two stories, chapters 3 and 4, John's putting them together. Say, whether you're really religious or really irreligious, Jesus is for you. Is he putting these two stories together in chapter 2 for a purpose of them going together? And I think there's a possibility that yes, there is. The stone jars are for ceremonial washing. The Jews were very ritualistic. They cleansed themselves regularly but they were all about external cleansing. And in the Gospels we hear Jesus speaking more about inner cleansing. And so the water, instead of being used for cleansing, is used to bring something different into that story. And then, of course, the temple is the place where the Jews should be worshipping. But they were corrupt in their worship in the temple. And so Jesus reforms the temple. He clears the temple. So is there something here about Jesus doing something new, overthrowing formal religion, overthrowing corrupt Jewish ritual? The imperfections of Jewish law being replaced by the new wine of the gospel of grace. And then the abundance of these six jars, 120 to 180 gallons of wine, demonstrating the abundance of God's grace for humankind. The Jews had a saying, without wine, there is no joy. Jesus turned a difficult situation into one of great joy. The Bible uses joy as an adjective to do with salvation, the joy of salvation. Isaiah chapter 12, with joy you will draw water from the wells of salvation. So maybe also there's a picture of salvation in here. Not Jewish ritual, but Jesus bringing salvation. And then, just as one final point, Jesus' first miracle. He didn't do it with a great big crowd, but he did it at a family celebration. The miracle itself, actually only the disciples, Jesus, Mary, the servants knew about. The rest didn't know. It wasn't a great spectacle. There's something humble about that, but also something beautiful about how Jesus blesses a human celebration, the celebration of a wedding. So there's various possibilities that could build upon the basic understanding of this miracle and why John chooses to include it. And I think actually that God can speak different parts of that to us at different times. That's one of the things about the Word of God. It's not dead words on a piece of paper. The Word of God is living and active, we're told, in Hebrews. And sometimes the Spirit can draw out different parts of the meaning for us at particular times. And so long as those are consistent with the overall message, then we can listen to the voice of the Spirit and they're backed up by the rest of the message. So who is Jesus to you this morning? Do you know Jesus' glory? And do you put your faith in him?